Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the latest cutting-edge research with expert analysis and engaging storytelling. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm Jen. In today's episode, we'll be exploring a fascinating paper that investigates the feasibility of conducting individual difference research online. The paper is titled Individual Differences in Online Research, Comparing Lab-Based and Online Administration of a Psycholinguistic Battery of Linguistic and Domain General Skills.
This is a really important question as more and more researchers are turning to online experiments, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The authors wanted to find out if conducting these complex individual difference studies online is just as reliable as doing them in a traditional lab setting.
Exactly. The researchers assembled a comprehensive psycholinguistic battery, covering everything from language production and comprehension to working memory and nonverbal reasoning. They then compared the performance of two large, demographically similar groups, one tested in the lab and one tested online.
That's a really clever approach. By looking at the same tasks across these two settings, they can isolate the potential impact of the online environment. This is crucial, because individual difference research is all about precisely measuring each person's abilities, not just looking at group-level effects.
Right. The researchers needed to know if the online setting would introduce too much noise or other confounding factors that could obscure those individual differences. Let's dive into the details of how they conducted this study.
The researchers recruited 149 young Dutch adults to complete the test battery in the lab, and 515 similar participants to do it online. The battery included 15 different tasks covering linguistic and domain general skills.
Some of the linguistic tasks were untimed, like antonym production, idiom recognition, and a vocabulary test. Others were timed, such as verbal fluency and rapid automatized naming. And they also looked at working memory and nonverbal reasoning abilities.
It's an impressively comprehensive set of measures. By including such a wide range, the researchers could really get a handle on whether the online setting would impact performance differently across task types.
Exactly. Let's take a closer look at a few of the key findings. When they compared the lab and online groups, the results were remarkably similar for most of the tasks. The distributions of scores, the means, medians, and standard deviations, they just lined up incredibly well.
That's really encouraging. It suggests that for the bulk of these psycholinguistic and cognitive assessments, the online setting doesn't introduce major distortions or biases. The participants seem to be performing just as reliably at home as they would in the lab.
However, the researchers did identify a few interesting exceptions. For the spelling task, participants actually scored about 5% higher on average when testing online compared to in the lab.
That's intriguing. Do you think the online participants might have been looking up the answers rather than relying solely on their own knowledge?
That's exactly what the researchers suspect. They note that in an online setting, it's much easier for participants to quickly search for information, whereas in the lab that option isn't available. So for tasks where looking up answers could provide a boost, the online group may have had an advantage.
That makes a lot of sense. But interestingly, they didn't see that same pattern play out for the idiom recognition task, even though participants could have looked up the meanings of the idioms just as easily.
Right. The researchers think participants may have only sought external help when it felt particularly important or convenient to do so. Being seen as a poor speller might carry more stigma than not knowing some idioms, so the online participants may have felt more compelled to maximize their spelling scores.
Fascinating. So the online setting doesn't automatically lead to looking up answers, but it does seem to open up that possibility in a way that the lab environment doesn't.
Exactly. The other key finding was that for a couple of the more challenging tasks, the nonverbal reasoning test and the antonym production, participants actually performed a bit better in the lab compared to online.
That's interesting. Do the researchers have any thoughts on why that might be the case?
They suspect it may come down to differences in motivation and engagement. In the lab setting, participants are physically present and under the watchful eye of an experimenter. But at home, It's easier for them to get distracted or lose focus, especially on more demanding tasks.
Right. Without that external pressure and structure of the lab, the online participants may have been more prone to disengaging or giving less than their full effort. That could be a real threat to the validity of individual difference research, where you really need people performing at their best.
Definitely. But the researchers also note that these differences were relatively small, and the model they used couldn't reliably distinguish them from zero overall. The majority of tasks showed no meaningful differences between the lab and online settings.
That's a really important point. While they identified a few potential issues to watch out for, the findings were still overwhelmingly positive about the potential for robust individual difference research online.
Exactly. The authors conclude that there's good reason for optimism in using online experiments to study individual differences, at least for the types of linguistic and cognitive skills they examined. As long as researchers are mindful of potential motivation and distraction factors, the online setting can provide a reliable and scalable platform.
That's such an exciting takeaway. Online research is opening up so many new possibilities, especially for individual difference work that requires large, diverse samples. With the right precautions, it seems researchers can harness the power of the online lab while still maintaining the precision needed for this type of study.
Absolutely. This paper really highlights the value of systematic, thoughtful comparisons between lab and online data collection. By carefully controlling the participant samples and testing the same comprehensive battery of tasks, the researchers were able to provide crucial guidance for the field.
I agree. This is such an important contribution. It speaks to the rigorous, innovative work being done to ensure the validity and reliability of online experiments, even for the most complex areas of psychological research. Listeners, I hope you're as excited about the future of online individual difference studies as we are.
Me too. This is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the insights we can gain by thoughtfully bridging the gap between the traditional lab and the new frontier of online research. There's so much more to discover, and we can't wait to bring you along for the ride.
Thanks for joining us today. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on all the latest breakthroughs we uncover. Until next time, keep exploring.
Catch you later.
Upbeat jingle plays. Are you tired of taking boring old personality tests that just tell you what you already know?
Well, get ready for Psychemetrics, the online individual difference assessment platform that goes way beyond surface-level traits.
With our cutting-edge battery of linguistic, cognitive, and domain general skill tests, we'll map your mind in ways you never imagined.
How's your antonym production game? Can you outmaneuver our nonverbal reasoning challenge? Find out now at psyche-metrics.com.
We've taken the guesswork out of understanding yourself. Just answer a few questions from the comfort of your own home, and let our advanced algorithms do the rest.
Uncover hidden talents, diagnose secret weaknesses. Psychemetrics is your window into the deepest recesses of your psyche.
So what are you waiting for? Head to psyche-metrics.com and unlock your true potential today.
Psychemetrics. Explore the mystery of you. Jingle plays out.
Here is the podcast episode transcript. Hello and welcome to the Cutting Edge Science Podcast, where we dive deep into the latest research to uncover fascinating discoveries. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm Jen, your other host. In this episode, we'll be exploring a research paper that sheds light on a crucial issue in the field of applied linguistics, the rise of online data collection.
That's right, Jen. The paper we'll be discussing is titled Online Data Collection in Applied Linguistics, and it's authored by Maria Todakosi, Zi Wu, and Nick B. Panza from the University of Maryland.
This is a really timely and important topic, Tom. The COVID-19 pandemic forced many researchers to quickly pivot to online methods for data collection. And even as in-person research has resumed, online approaches have remained popular, offering some key advantages for applied linguists.
Exactly. The authors highlight how online data collection can help researchers access wider and more diverse samples of participants, which is especially valuable when studying less commonly taught languages or specific bilingual populations. But of course, this comes with its own set of challenges and considerations.
That's right. In this paper, the authors provide a comprehensive set of practical guidelines and recommendations for applied linguists looking to effectively implement online research. They cover everything from participant recruitment strategies to ensuring data quality, all the way through the nuts and bolts of online experiment design and deployment.
It's a really thorough and insightful analysis. The authors don't just focus on the theoretical implications of online research, but dive deep into the nitty-gritty details that researchers need to navigate.
Absolutely. One of the key areas they explore is participant recruitment. The traditional methods like posting flyers on campus have their limitations when going online. The authors outline alternatives like using social media, contacting other institutions, and leveraging crowdsourcing platforms like Prolific and Amazon's Mechanical Turk.
Right, and each of those approaches has its own pros and cons. For example, social media can help you reach a more diverse pool of participants, but it also opens the door to potential issues like bots or people motivated solely by compensation. The crowdsourcing platforms are super efficient for quickly gathering large samples, but the data quality can be a concern.
Exactly. That's why the authors stress the importance of incorporating quality assurance measures, like eligibility criteria, comprehension checks, and attention checks. They even discuss the option of making compensation contingent on good performance to incentivize engaged participation.
This is where the authors' real-world experience really shines through. They've clearly run into these challenges themselves and are providing concrete solutions. For example, they talk about the value of establishing a shared participant pool across research labs to streamline recruitment and ensure participants' consent is properly obtained.
Definitely. And the level of technical detail they go into for the implementation and deployment phases is really impressive. They compare the pros and cons of different experiment building platforms like PsychoPy and Gorilla, highlighting important considerations around cost, user-friendliness, and technical support.
Absolutely. They cover everything from potential software issues with character encoding and case sensitivity, to hardware differences that can introduce unwanted variability in the data. And they emphasize the importance of thorough piloting and troubleshooting before launching a full-scale online study.
One of the most fascinating aspects is their discussion of online proctoring. They explain how researchers can leverage tools like Zoom to maintain a level of environmental control and real-time monitoring that's often lost in unproctored online studies. Things like enforcing breaks, recording sessions for redundancy, and using breakout rooms to scale up proctoring.
Right, and they acknowledge that online proctoring comes with its own trade-offs, like added time and effort for the researcher. But they provide creative solutions, like using multiple devices and breakout rooms to streamline the process and make it more efficient.
It's clear the authors have thought deeply about all the challenges and complexities involved in transitioning to online data collection. But throughout the paper, they maintain a very pragmatic and solutions-oriented approach.
Definitely. They're not just highlighting the problems, but offering concrete, field-tested recommendations that can really help applied linguists navigate this shift. It's a fantastic resource for anyone looking to leverage the benefits of online research while mitigating the potential pitfalls.
Absolutely. One thing that really stood out to me is how the authors emphasize the importance of continuing to share knowledge and best practices within the field. They acknowledge that online research methods are constantly evolving, and they encourage other researchers to build on this work and contribute their own insights.
That's a great point, Jen. The authors recognize that this is just the beginning, and that as a community, we need to keep pushing the boundaries of what's possible with online data collection. There's still so much to learn, and by sharing our experiences and discoveries, we can collectively advance the methodological rigor and validity of research in applied linguistics.
Exactly. This paper lays an excellent foundation, but the work is far from done. I'm really excited to see how online data collection continues to evolve and how researchers build on these recommendations to unlock new possibilities for the field.
Me too, Jen. This is such a critical juncture, and the authors of this paper have provided an invaluable roadmap for navigating it. Online data collection is here to stay, and with thoughtful, systematic approaches like the ones outlined in this study, we can ensure it becomes a powerful tool for driving discovery and innovation in applied linguistics.
Well said, Tom. This has been a fascinating deep dive into a really important piece of research. I'm sure our listeners have gained a lot of insights and practical knowledge that they can apply to their own work. Thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to exploring more cutting-edge science with you soon.
Thanks, Jen. Until next time, keep exploring the frontiers of knowledge. Are you tired of the hassle and uncertainty of conducting online research?
Introducing Panzer Proctors, the innovative solution for reliable, high-quality online data collection.
Panzer Proctors combines the latest AI-powered monitoring with a team of highly trained human proctors to ensure your online studies are rock solid.
Forget about bots, cheaters, and technical glitches. Our system will keep your participants engaged, attentive, and honest every step of the way.
Need to scale up your online studies? No problem. Our proctors can handle hundreds of participants simultaneously, all while maintaining the integrity of your data.
And the best part? Panzer Proctors comes with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you're not completely blown away by the quality of your online data, we'll refund your money. No questions asked.
So why settle for the chaos of unproctored online research? Experience the Panzer Proctors difference and take your applied linguistics studies to new heights of rigor and reliability.
Visit panzerproctors.com to learn more and book your demo today.
Panzer Proctors, ironclad online data, guaranteed. Here is a detailed podcast episode transcript about the research paper The Evolution of Similarity-Biased Social Learning. Hello and welcome to the Curiosity Lab podcast. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. We're so glad you could join us today as we investigate the fascinating new research on the evolution of similarity-biased social learning.
That's right, Jen. In this episode, we'll be diving deep into a cutting-edge study that sheds light on why humans often prefer to learn from people who share our social identities.
The paper is titled The Evolution of Similarity-Biased Social Learning and it's authored by Paul E. Smaldino and Alejandro Perez Valilla. Their findings offer a compelling functional explanation for this widespread human bias.
Social learning, that is, learning from observing and imitating others, is absolutely crucial for humans. We're what's called obligate social learners. We rely on others to acquire the vast majority of our knowledge and behaviors.
But we don't just learn from anyone. Humans often show a strong preference for learning from members of our own social groups or in-groups, people who share our race, gender, age, cultural background, and so on. We tend to ignore or reject information coming from perceived out-group members.
This similarity-biased or parochial social learning has some well-known downsides. It can exacerbate cultural divides, polarization, and intergroup conflict. And it means we may miss out on valuable information that could be useful, even for tackling existential threats.
So why do we exhibit this bias, even when it seems to work against our best interests? That's the question Smaldino and Perez Valilla set out to investigate. And through their formal computational modeling, they uncovered a compelling functional explanation.
The key insight is that in diverse, heterogeneous environments, parochial social learning can actually be an adaptive strategy. By selectively focusing on learning from people who are similar to us, we're more likely to acquire behaviors that are truly relevant and useful given our own circumstances.
You see, the researchers found that unbiased social learning, just randomly copying behaviors from others, tends to break down when there's a lot of diversity in the population. If the optimal behaviors for one group are very different from the optimal behaviors for another group, then indiscriminately learning from anyone is not going to be very effective.
But when people can use markers of social identity to preferentially learn from those who are likely to have relevant knowledge, it can boost the efficiency of social learning and make it adaptive even in diverse settings. As long as those identity markers provide at least some reliable signal about a person's circumstances and the behaviors that work for them, parochialism can pay off.
The model shows that this effect is strongest when individual learning is quite error-prone. In noisy, complex environments where directly figuring things out on your own is difficult, being able to selectively target social learning toward the right models becomes really valuable.
Interestingly, the researchers also found that parochialism works best for majority groups. Members of minority groups don't get as much of a benefit, because they're more likely to have their potential social learning targets come from the outgroup by chance.
And the researchers looked at how this plays out when you add in other sophisticated social learning strategies like conformist and payoff bias transmission. While those can provide their own benefits, parochialism still plays a key role in maintaining the adaptive value of social learning, especially when identity markers are reasonably reliable.
One particularly fascinating result is that payoff-biased social learning, where you preferentially copy the behaviors of successful individuals, can actually create a trap for disadvantaged groups if they haven't first evolved strong parochialism. Without that similarity-based filter, they end up consistently copying members of the better-performing group, further entrenching their own suboptimal outcomes.
So in summary, Smaldino and Perez-Villila provide a compelling functional explanation for why similarity-biased social learning persists, even with its downsides. By directing our attention to the most relevant social models, parochialism can make social learning adaptive in diverse, uncertain environments.
Of course, the researchers are quick to point out the dangers of over-relying on social identity as a guide. Defining people solely in terms of group markers can lead to harmful stereotyping, dehumanization, and polarization. And parochialism may prevent us from accessing important information from outgroup members, with potentially catastrophic consequences.
Absolutely. This is a complex issue with both benefits and costs. The key seems to be finding the right balance, leveraging the adaptive value of parochialism when appropriate, while also cultivating the openness and equity necessary for a thriving, pluralistic society. It's a fascinating challenge that this research helps illuminate.
Wonderfully said, Jen. This study truly gets at the heart of one of the fundamental tensions in human social learning and cognition. How do we navigate the trade-offs between the convenience of similarity-based heuristics and the importance of engaging with diverse perspectives? It's a question that will continue to fascinate researchers and policymakers alike.
Absolutely. I found this paper to be a masterful blend of conceptual insight and rigorous, formal modeling. Smaldino and Perez-Villila have made a valuable contribution to our understanding of this ubiquitous human bias. It's the kind of work that not only illuminates an important phenomenon, but also opens up rich avenues for future exploration.
I couldn't agree more. This was a truly thought-provoking episode. Thank you all for joining us on this journey through the evolution of similarity-biased social learning. We hope you found it as fascinating as we did. Until next time, keep exploring.
See you next time on the Curiosity Lab.
Here is a funny and weird commercial for a new company that emerged from the insights in the evolution of similarity-biased social learning research paper. Are you tired of feeling like an outcast, constantly ignored by the in-crowd? Well, have we got the solution for you.
Introducing Parochial Pals, the social learning app that matches you with your perfect, socially identical learning partner.
That's right. With Parochial Pals, you'll only be connected with people who are just like you. Same race, gender, age, hobbies, shoe size, you name it, we've got your back.
No more wasting time trying to learn from those pesky outgroup members. Parochial Pals ensures you only get information from people who are guaranteed to have the same optimal behaviors as you.
So download Parochial Pals today, and start surrounding yourself with your ideal, similarity-approved learning companions. Because who needs diversity when you've got Parochial Pals?
Parochial Pals. Keeping you in your comfortable, cultural bubble. Available now on the App Store and Google Play.
Here is the podcast episode transcript. Hello and welcome to the Cutting Edge Discoveries podcast, where we dive deep into the latest scientific research and unpack the fascinating stories behind the breakthroughs. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm Jen. On today's episode, we'll be exploring a paper that investigates how to optimize a powerful large language model called Llama 7B for the task of medical question answering. This is some really exciting stuff that could have big implications for healthcare.
That's right, Jen. The paper is titled Optimizing Llama 7B for Medical Question Answering, a study on fine-tuning strategies and performance on the MultiMed QA dataset. It was authored by Farizal Hamza and Narayani Sulaiman, and it delves into the ways they were able to significantly boost Llama 7B's abilities when it comes to understanding and answering complex medical queries.
Llama 7B is a cutting-edge large language model, meaning it's an AI system trained on vast amounts of text data to develop a deep understanding of human language. With 7 billion parameters, it's an incredibly powerful and versatile model. But as the researchers point out, to excel at specialized tasks like medical question answering, it needs to be fine-tuned and optimized.
Exactly. The core of this study was exploring different fine-tuning strategies to see which ones could unlock Llama 7B's full potential in the medical domain. Fine-tuning involves taking a pre-trained model and further training it on a specific dataset to enhance its performance on a particular task.
And the dataset they used was MultiMed QA, which is a comprehensive collection of real-world medical questions and answers covering a wide range of topics, from symptoms and diagnoses to treatments and prescriptions. It's an excellent benchmark for evaluating a model's medical question answering capabilities.
The researchers didn't just apply a standard fine-tuning approach, though. They systematically tested out a variety of techniques to find the most effective ways to optimize Llama 7B. This included adjusting the learning rate, gradually unfreezing the model layers, integrating domain-specific medical vocabulary, selectively fine-tuning certain layers, and incorporating regularization methods.
That's a really thoughtful and meticulous approach. By trying out all these different strategies, they were able to uncover the specific fine-tuning recipes that unlocked dramatic improvements in Llama 7B's performance on the MultiMed QA dataset.
Absolutely. When they started, the baseline performance of Llama 7B on the dataset was decent, with accuracy, precision, recall, and F1 scores ranging from around 60% to 75% across different categories like symptoms, diagnosis, and treatment. But after implementing their fine-tuning strategies, the model's metrics skyrocketed.
That's really impressive. Can you tell us more about the specific fine-tuning techniques they used and how they impacted the model's performance?
Sure, let's dive into the details. One of the key things they did was carefully adjust the learning rate during the fine-tuning process. They found that using a lower learning rate, rather than a higher one, allowed the model to gradually absorb the medical knowledge without catastrophically forgetting its original, more general language understanding capabilities.
That makes a lot of sense. Maintaining that balance between specialized learning and preserving broader knowledge is crucial. What other strategies did they employ?
Another technique they used was graduated unfreezing. Normally, when fine-tuning a model, you unfreeze all the layers at once and let them all update during training. But the researchers found that it was more effective to unfreeze the layers in a phased manner, starting with the top layers closest to the output. This allowed the model to first adjust its higher level, more abstract representations before moving on to the lower level details.
Interesting. That's a clever way to guide the model's learning process in a more structured way. What about integrating domain-specific vocabulary? How did that help?
That was a really important step. The researchers extended Llama 7B's tokenizer, which is the component that maps text to numerical representations the model can understand, by adding in relevant medical terminology and concepts from the MultiMed QA dataset. This ensured the model had a much richer vocabulary to draw from when processing medical questions and generating responses.
That makes total sense. If the model doesn't have a solid grasp of the specialized language used in the medical domain, it's going to struggle to comprehend and answer those types of questions accurately. Expanding the vocabulary was clearly a key part of their optimization strategy.
Absolutely. They also experimented with selectively fine-tuning certain layers of the Llama 7B model, rather than updating all the parameters at once. This allowed them to focus the model's learning on the specific parts that were most relevant for understanding medical questions and answers.
That's a really smart approach. Rather than blindly fine-tuning the entire model, they were able to surgically target the components that would have the biggest impact on the task at hand. And I imagine the regularization techniques they used, like dropout and weight decay, also played an important role in preventing overfitting and maintaining the model's generalization abilities.
Exactly. The researchers had to be really careful, because the medical domain is so specialized and complex. They didn't want the model to become too narrowly focused on the training data and lose its broader language understanding capabilities. The regularization helped keep things balanced.
Wow. It's clear the researchers took a very thoughtful and multifaceted approach to optimizing Llama 7B. And the results speak for themselves. They were able to boost the model's accuracy, precision, recall, and F1 scores quite significantly across all the different medical question categories.
That's right. By the end of their fine-tuning process, Llama 7B was achieving accuracy scores well above 80% in many areas, with F1 scores consistently over 0.80 as well. It was a dramatic improvement from the baseline, showing just how powerful these fine-tuning strategies can be.
This is really exciting stuff. Not only does it demonstrate the potential of large language models like Llama 7B to excel at specialized tasks like medical question answering, but it also provides a roadmap for how to effectively fine-tune and optimize these powerful AI systems.
Absolutely. The researchers didn't just improve Llama 7B's performance. They also contributed a comprehensive methodological framework for fine-tuning large language models in other specialized domains. This study really pushes the boundaries of what's possible with these advanced AI models when you apply thoughtful, targeted optimization techniques.
I agree, Tom. This work has huge implications. Imagine how this could transform medical information retrieval and support systems, providing healthcare professionals and patients with more accurate, reliable, and contextually relevant answers to their questions. It's a game changer.
Definitely. And beyond the medical field, this kind of fine-tuning approach could be applied to unlock the potential of large language models in all sorts of specialized domains, finance, law, education, you name it. The researchers have really laid the groundwork for a whole new frontier of AI optimization and application.
Absolutely. This was a fascinating look into the cutting-edge research happening in this space. Tom, I'm really impressed by the creativity and rigor the researchers brought to this study. Their fine-tuning strategies were so thoughtful and nuanced, and the results they achieved are truly remarkable.
I couldn't agree more, Jen. This is the kind of work that really pushes the boundaries of what's possible with AI. By meticulously fine-tuning Llama 7B, the researchers have demonstrated the immense potential of large language models to tackle complex, specialized tasks in fields like healthcare. It's an exciting glimpse into the future.
Definitely. This study is a prime example of how innovative, interdisciplinary research can lead to transformative breakthroughs. I'm left feeling really inspired and curious to see what other advancements emerge as the field of AI optimization continues to evolve.
Me too, Jen. This was a captivating dive into the world of fine-tuning large language models, and I think our listeners are going to be just as fascinated by it as we are. Thanks for joining me today. This was a great discussion.
Absolutely, Tom. It was a pleasure. Until next time, keep exploring those cutting-edge discoveries.
Dramatic announcer voice. Do you suffer from a severe case of the dum-dums when it comes to answering medical questions? Are you a total knucklehead when your loved one asks about their rash, their aches, or their strange bodily functions? Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing Dr. Llama, the world's first AI medical assistant trained by the brilliant minds behind the Llama 7B optimization study. Llama Puppet appears on screen, wearing a lab coat and stethoscope. Llama. Hola, I am Dr. Llama. With my advanced medical knowledge and soothing demeanor, I am here to answer all your health questions. Llama puppet starts awkwardly examining a stuffed animal patient llama. Yes, very interesting. It seems your puppy has a case of the fluffles. The treatment is simple 20 belly rubs per day and unlimited snackaroos. Llama puppet gives thumbs up. Don't be a dummy. Call on Dr. Llama. Our state-of-the-art AI will have you feeling better in no time. Side effects may include excessive drooling, sudden craving for hay, and an uncontrollable urge to spit in your palm. Call 1-800-LLAMA-MD today. Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to the award-winning podcast where we dive deep into cutting-edge research. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi, everyone. Today we're going to be discussing a fascinating paper that explores the intersection of family migration and occupational penalty for migrant women in the Italian labor market. The paper is titled Exploring the Intersection Between Family Migration and Occupational Penalty, a study of migrant women in the Italian labor market, and it's authored by Nazareno Panicella.
This is really an important topic that doesn't get enough attention. As we know, immigrants often face significant barriers and disadvantages when it comes to finding good jobs and advancing in their careers. But the challenges can be even more pronounced for immigrant women.
That's right. The paper looks at how family migration dynamics, particularly the phenomenon of tied migration, can exacerbate the occupational penalty experienced by migrant women in Italy. Let's dive in and see what the researchers discovered.
The study used data from the Survey of Social Condition and Integration of Foreign Citizens, which surveyed over 10,000 adult migrants living in Italy. The researchers focused on three key occupational outcomes: the likelihood of being economically active, the probability of being employed at the time of the interview, and the likelihood of avoiding low-skilled, unskilled work.
The key independent variable they looked at was the migrant's family migration history. They compared the occupational outcomes of male migrants to female migrants, specifically examining whether women who migrated as tied migrants, following their husbands rather than migrating independently, faced an additional penalty beyond what male migrants experienced.
That's a really interesting angle. The researchers are getting at this idea that migration decisions aren't always made by individuals in isolation, but rather as part of a family unit trying to maximize the overall family's well-being. And that can sometimes come at the expense of the woman's own career prospects.
Exactly. The human capital theory of migration proposes that families will often make migration decisions based on what's best for the whole, even if it doesn't necessarily maximize each individual's economic outcomes. And unfortunately, those family-level decisions tend to prioritize the man's career, relegating the woman to a trailing spouse role.
So what did the researchers find when they looked at the data? Did the results support this idea of an additional penalty for migrant women, especially those who migrated as tied spouses?
Yes, the findings were quite compelling. The results confirmed that migrant women do indeed experience an additional occupational penalty compared to migrant men. And this penalty was exacerbated for women who migrated after their husbands or in conjunction with their husbands, versus women who migrated independently.
That's really fascinating. Can you tell us a bit more about how this played out in the data? What were some of the specific differences they found between the groups of women?
Absolutely. The researchers found that women who migrated as tied migrants, either following their husbands or migrating at the same time, had lower probabilities of being economically active, being employed, and avoiding the lowest rungs of the occupational ladder compared to women who migrated independently, before their husbands, or alone. This effect was most pronounced for women from Middle Eastern countries. For this group, tied migration had a particularly negative impact on their employability, the quality of the jobs they were able to obtain, and their overall position within the occupational structure in Italy.
Wow. That's a really striking finding. It seems like the family migration dynamic is creating an extra barrier for these women, above and beyond the general challenges that immigrants face in the labor market. Can you help us unpack why that might be the case?
The researchers suggest a few key reasons. First, when women migrate as tied spouses, they may have less autonomy and agency in the migration decision-making process. Their own career goals and human capital development may take a backseat to their husband's employment prospects. Additionally, as trailing spouses, these women may have less time to invest in building country-specific skills like language proficiency. They may also have more disruptions to their employment history, making it harder to establish a stable career trajectory.
That makes a lot of sense. So in essence, the family migration model is putting these women in a position where they have to prioritize their husband's career over their own, which then compounds the challenges they face in the labor market. It's almost a double whammy of disadvantage.
Absolutely. And the researchers point out that this dynamic is further exacerbated by broader institutional factors and cultural norms within the Italian context. There are still strong gender imbalances and traditional views about the role of women, which can make it even harder for migrant women to break out of these tied migration patterns and achieve occupational success.
This is a really important study that sheds light on a complex and underexplored issue. By focusing specifically on the migrant population and comparing women to men, the researchers were able to isolate the unique effects of family migration dynamics in a way that studies comparing immigrants to natives often can't.
Definitely. The paper highlights how overly simplistic comparisons between migrants and natives can miss crucial nuances within the migrant population itself. These family-level factors play a huge role in shaping the occupational trajectories of immigrant women, and addressing them will be key to promoting more equitable labor market integration.
Well said. This was a really insightful and thought-provoking discussion. Before we wrap up, Jen, what are your main takeaways from this research? What do you find most compelling or surprising?
A few things really struck me. First, the extent to which the male-led model of family migration continues to persist, even in more modern migration flows, and the detrimental impact that has on women's careers. It's a sobering reminder that gender inequalities can often get baked into the very structures and processes of migration. I'm also struck by how the negative effects of tied migration were particularly acute for women from certain cultural contexts, like the Middle East. It underscores how migration experiences are shaped not just by individual factors, but by broader social and institutional forces in both the origin and destination countries. Ultimately, I think this research highlights the critical need to consider family dynamics and gender power dynamics when trying to understand and address the labor market challenges facing immigrant populations. It's a complex issue, but one that deserves much more attention.
I completely agree. This study really gets at the heart of how migration is fundamentally a family and gendered process, with profound implications for how immigrant women are able to integrate economically. It's an important reminder that a one-size-fits-all approach to labor market integration won't work. We need to understand and address these nuanced, intersectional challenges. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us and exploring this fascinating research on family migration and occupational penalty. Be sure to check out the full paper if you want to dive deeper into the details. Until next time, this is Tom and Jen signing off. Have you ever felt like you're always playing second fiddle to your spouse, even when it comes to your own career?
Are you a migrant woman struggling to get ahead in the job market, all because your husband's career took priority in your family's big move?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing Trailing Spouse Empowerment.
That's right, Trailing Spouse Empowerment. The career coaching service specifically designed to help immigrant women like you break free from the shackles of tied migration and finally take control of your professional destiny.
Our team of experienced life and career coaches will work with you one-on-one to overcome the unique challenges you face. We'll help you build the confidence, skills, and networks you need to stop being an afterthought and start being the main event.
Don't let your husband's ambition derail your own dreams. With Trailing Spouse Empowerment, we'll get you back on the fast track to the career you deserve.
So what are you waiting for? Visit TrailingSpouseEmpowerment.com and take the first step towards a future where you come first.
Trailing Spouse Empowerment. Putting you, the migrant woman, in the driver's seat.